Well, this course is called Anatomy and Physiology, so it's supposed to be about both of those things, although 201 compared to 202 is more about anatomy than physiology. There is some physiology. 202 is also anatomy, but it has more physiology in it than this course. What's the difference between those two things, though? First of all, what is anatomy? It's a study of structure, whereas physiology is the study of function, how those parts work. And so this is a course that has certainly no shortage of information in it. Any biology course is a pretty vocabulary-intensive course, right? You've noticed, if you've taken other biology courses, you've noticed that there's just a hell of a lot of vocabulary terms that are brand new words, and this is really no exception. It's probably more so than other biology courses. And I really encourage you to think about words etymologically. If you have never cared about word roots, it's really a good thing to be able to develop an understanding of, because it just makes things a hell of a lot easier from here on out. Not just scholastically, it helps you just in everyday life. And so that's why I'm going to, usually when we're faced with a new word, try to tell you why it's called that. You know, if you just try to memorize a bunch of words as though they're telephone numbers with no meaning, it's going to be a lot more difficult than if you really just pay attention to what the roots mean. That, and then when you're confronted with a word you've never seen, but that you know the roots of, you can figure out what it means. That's a valuable tool. Anyway, anatomy is structure, physiology is function, and the difference between 201 and 202, in case you're going on to both of them, is really just where we artificially make the division of what starting and stopping. 201 is going to have some basic introductory material, but then we're going to go on to surveying organ systems. And the organ systems that we treat in this course will be muscular system, skeletal system, nervous system, integumentary system. We're spending a lot of time in the nervous system because that includes things like special senses and divisions of the nervous system and so on. So that's really all we cover in this course. 202 is all the other organ systems that we don't treat here, like reproductive system, endocrine system, digestive system, and so on. So when I say an organ system, what am I referring to? Well, this first slide shows you an organ system. This is the digestive system as an example. But it's placed here in what overall, shown here, is a hierarchy, meaning a nested arrangement. It's really, what you see here is part of an even bigger hierarchy, which is the hierarchy of biological organization. And so you can really start at the same bottom here. Atoms combine in certain ways to form larger structures called molecules that have greater complexity. Molecules, in turn, combine to form more complex structures that are themselves molecules, but much larger than your run-of-the-mill molecule, macromolecules, and all life, not just humans, which we're focusing on in this course, all cells, which all organisms contain, are made up of four kinds of biological macromolecules. Who can tell me what those are? Sorry, I didn't hear you. No, although I'll give you half credit for that. Did everyone hear what she said? And that's because you're not speaking loudly as I am, which students rarely do. But when you answer my questions, try to speak this loudly. Literally, there's 100 people in here almost. She said carbohydrates. Why is that not a good enough answer? Any of my veterans know this? Well, yes, we can go on to lipids, which is a correct answer, but why is carbohydrates not one of the four macromolecule types? That's because carbohydrates aren't necessarily macromolecules. It's a huge class of molecules, including big and small molecules. For instance, glucose is a monosaccharide, right? A monosaccharide is a carbohydrate, but it's not a macromolecule. You don't make a sugar macromolecule unless you combine together a bunch of monosaccharides to form what? A polysaccharide, which is one of the four macromolecule types. So you have lipids, polysaccharides. What are the other two? Nucleic acids, which include RNA and DNA. And proteins. Correct. Those four big biological molecules, or macromolecules, are what every living thing that's ever existed, what they're made out of. So that's the next level in this hierarchy of organization. Those macromolecules combine in various ways to make larger structures called organelles. Now, this is true. This organelle shown here, does anyone know what that is? It's a mitochondrion, but that doesn't really matter. It's an example, though, of a membrane-bounded organelle, which only certain kinds of cells have. So there's a dichotomy in biology, a two-part way of looking at things, meaning that there's fundamentally two different types of cells in biology. What are those two types? These two types are, the basis for the distinction is the presence or absence of membrane-bounded organelles, including a nucleus. So what do we call cells that lack a true nucleus? Prokaryotes. Those cells are called prokaryotic cells. The karyo part of that word means kernel or core. The core of the cell is the nucleus if it has one. Not all cells have a true nucleus, which is where the DNA is, but it's wrapped in its own membrane. Well, a cell that has a true nucleus is called eukaryotic. The EU part of that word means true, so it means having a true nucleus, literally. So those are the two major kinds of cells. We are eukaryotic organisms. All animals are. We're animals, of course. So the next level for us is the organelle level. Organelles combine, various kinds of organelles combine to make up the overall cell. And that's where it would end for certain species. Because there are unicellular organisms, right? Like a bacterium. Almost every organism that's ever existed, and almost every organism that exists right now, is a bacterium. Because they vastly outnumber us. They are unicellular and prokaryotic. But we are unicellular organisms as animals, so we can continue going. And what I'm trying to say is that for a unicellular organism, the cell level and eventually the organism level are really the same thing, but not for us. Multicellular organisms arrange different types of cells into bigger structures called tissues, more complex structures called tissues. And we as vertebrates are made up of four major kinds of tissue. Anyone know those? Muscular tissue, good. Didn't hear that. Connective tissue? Skeletal tissue is an example of connective tissue. So that's a subset. Did you say cardiac? That's a type of muscle tissue. So that's also a subset. The two that we haven't mentioned are epithelial tissue and nervous tissue. And we'll be talking about those different types of tissues later. But that's the next level in this hierarchy of complexity. Different tissues then combine to form more complex structures called organs, like the stomach shown here. The stomach, though, works hand in hand with other kinds of organs for a similar function, like digestion. And so it's a member of a more complex thing called an organ system. And that's what I was saying earlier. We're surveying in 201 and 202, the various organ systems. We're going to treat them in isolation. Of course, they don't work isolatedly. They have to work hand in hand with each other. But then organ systems of different types combine to form the overall organism if we're talking about a multicellular organism like we are. And then what I was saying before is that this is really just part of a bigger hierarchy because organisms of the same type collect to form a species, and so I mean a population, and so on, all the way up to the biosphere, which is includes all organisms. All right, let's go on to slide 2. By the way, I didn't mention that my slides will have almost no text on them. They're really just pictures from the book by design. I don't want you to waste time writing down any text that's on the slideshows because you already have the slideshows. That's a total waste of time. It's worse than a waste of time. It distracts you from listening to me while I'm speaking. That's why I don't have text up there. But another thing I wanted to mention is that I don't refer to figure numbers because you might be using a totally different book, which is fine. Instead, I always refer to slide numbers, which are the red numbers in the bottom right. And I really recommend when you write your notes during the live performance that you put down what slide you're on and draw a line every time I switch. I'll make a point to say what slide I'm on so that you can follow the recording at home. The second slide, though, really is just an example of the fact that humans differ from individual to individual in what their organs look like. So there is a normal type, a so-called normal, simply because it's the average. Most people have that type, but there can be considerable variation. So you have the normal kidneys placed more or less side by side. Most humans, one of them is a little lower than the other. But it's possible to have a pelvic kidney or a horseshoe-shaped kidney, which is really all one big kidney. That's not an abnormality, really. It works just fine. It's just part of the variation caused by natural selection. And similarly with the heart, notice that the shape of the heart is the same, but how these vessels are connected to each other can vary from human to human. And that's why it's important to really look at real samples when you do dissections, for instance, because even if you use the same species, individual to individual is not going to look exactly the same. Okay, now to 3. This first chapter, by the way, is we can kind of breeze through it. It's just some really basic ideas about biology in general, but anatomy and physiology specifically. What we're looking at in this third slide, though, is the notion of feedback. There are two types of feedback. Those are positive feedback and negative feedback. And one of those is much more rare than the other in living things. Which one is the usual type of feedback? Negative feedback is much more common than positive feedback. And that's because negative feedback is the only kind of feedback that can lead to or maintain homeostasis, which, by the way, can also be pronounced homeostasis, but most people say homeostasis. What is homeostasis? Well, stasis refers to staying the same. Something can be either static, unchanging, or dynamic, changing. So stasis means the quality of not really changing, at least not much. Homeostasis is the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. And so there's many different components to that. For instance, we as endothermic homeotherms make sure that we maintain a pretty tight narrow range of body temperatures. We can't tolerate a body temperature too low or too high. And similarly, most people can't tolerate a room that's either too cold or too hot, which is why the part A of this figure is shown here. Well, a thermostat operates to maintain thermostasis, which is one aspect of homeostasis, by operating through negative feedback. The reason it's called negative feedback is because this type of feedback negate means totally get rid of, but negative feedback is called negative feedback because it seeks to negate an error. So there's an error in the system, whatever system we're talking about, if there is a difference between the set point, the desired value, and what the actual value is at that moment. All right? So there is a set point that you set on the thermostat. That's the desired temperature. But it's almost never the case that the room is exactly that temperature. If it's too hot, then an air conditioner can turn on, triggered by the thermostat, right? Which is constantly reading the current temperature. So that would be an error in one direction, right? Turning on the air conditioner in a room that's too hot is an example of negative feedback because you're trying to negate that error. If it gets too cold, though, it's going to turn it off, right? That's still negative feedback because now you have an error in the other direction. You still want to negate it. So negative feedback always brings the variable, whatever that variable is, in this case temperature, closer to the set point. So don't think of negative feedback being in one direction with respect to an error in one direction, whereas positive feedback treats an error in the other direction. That's the wrong way of thinking about this. Positive feedback never leads to homeostasis because it always makes the variable farther from set point. In other words, it increases the error. Okay? So that's why it can never lead to homeostasis. And a physiological example that corresponds to this thermostasis in the room is your own body's thermostasis. So 37 is roughly the set point in your brain. 37 degrees that's just an average body temperature. It pisses me off, by the way, that they write it as 98.6 Fahrenheit. Not because 37 doesn't equal 98.6, but it implies that we maintain our body temperature to a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit. We don't do that. The only reason that 98.6 degrees is listed as normal human body temperature is because the first people who cared about this and measured it in enough people to get a good average were Germans, which of course used the SANE system, the metric system, and so they just rounded it to the nearest integer. 37 degrees was the average to the nearest whole degree. So when you convert that to Fahrenheit, yes, it equals 98.6, but that 0.6 is meaningless. So normal human body temperature is around 99 degrees Fahrenheit, which is still more accurate than 37 because there's 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit per centigrade degree. Anyway, that's the set point, and that is in your brain under, at normal times. Actually, the set point can be changed depending on the conditions. But that set point is right here. It's constant at the moment. Your body is almost never exactly that temperature, though. So when your body temperature is too hot, which the body knows about because you have a nervous system, then it will respond by vasodilation, which will send more blood to the skin where it's close to the surface, and you will conductively lose some heat, but you'll also increase sweating. Sweating evaporatively cools your body, and therefore it's negating the error by bringing your body temperature back toward set point. If you get too cold, though, you're going to start shivering. Vasoconstriction is shutting down the blood flow so that you're not sending heat, which the blood is carrying, to the surface where it can exchange it with the environment. But you're also going to shiver, which is really just using your muscles instead of for moving something, just to create friction. Shivering is just uncontrolled muscular movement that frictionally warms you up. That's also negative feedback, though, because it's negating the error in the other direction. In slide 4, we see really just another example of negative feedback. But it also kind of shows you how it's not always a change in the external environment that is causing a change in the variable. Sometimes it's something you're doing, like rising from bed. Going to an upright posture is going to change the fluid dynamics of your circulation. And so when blood drains, that's going to cause lower pressure in parts of your body. And the baroreceptors, baro meaning pressure, baroreceptors located in your body are going to actually sense what your blood pressure is at that moment. And if it's too low, that's an error. So negative feedback comes to the rescue by putting into play mechanisms that will increase the output of the heart. It will make it squeeze with greater force, and it will make it beat more rapidly, both of which put more blood into the vasculature, which increases the pressure, because the more blood you try to force into the vessel, the more pressurized it gets, until it's back to being correct. That's negative feedback. Now, I told you that positive feedback is comparatively rare. Doesn't mean that there aren't positive feedback mechanisms, though. There are examples. Slide 5 gives you the classic example, which most textbooks use. It's not the only example, but it's a good example. This one is parturition, otherwise known as childbirth. So when the baby's about to drop out or pop out, it will drop in the uterus, and a normal position will be head down, right? So that skull is going to stretch the cervix of the uterus. Cervix means neck, so it's the same word we use for this neck, but a woman also has a uterine cervix. It's a neck is like a bottleneck, right? It's a narrowing. So when that wide head is trying to be forced through that narrow cervix, that cervix is going to be stretched. That stretching gets recepted. There are mechanoreceptors that sense that stretch, send a signal to the brain saying that it's being stretched. The brain responds by releasing a hormone called oxytocin into the bloodstream. Oxytocin, like any hormone, operates as a signal, which does nothing to any part of the body unless that part of the body has a receptor that is able to recognize that signal. Well, the receptors that are able to recognize that signal are in the uterus. So when the oxytocin released from the brain gets delivered via the bloodstream to the uterus, it will tell the uterus to contract even stronger, squeezing from above, pushing that head even farther into the cervix, stretching it even more. That increases the error. So that's going to send an even more urgent signal to the brain to release even more oxytocin, and it keeps building. Positive feedback always has this building characteristic to it. It's always making the error worse. Now, positive feedback mechanisms they are always temporary. Either they're temporary in a normal sense, because whatever they accomplish gets done. For instance, the baby pops out, and they are thereafter replaced by negative feedback mechanisms that restore homeostasis. Or they're temporary because you die. You know, for instance, if someone hacks off my arm, I'm going to obviously lose a lot of blood, right? That blood loss is going to cause a drastic drop in blood pressure, which will be sensed by my body in a way that would normally be negative feedback. My body's going to respond in what would normally be negative feedback to actually restore my blood pressure. Like we talked about in the previous slide, that's going to make my heart work harder. What's going to happen? It's going to gush more blood out of my stump, which is going to make my blood pressure get even lower. And so that's just going to build until I'm either rescued or I die. So all positive feedback mechanisms are temporary. Six now. Let's shift gears. This is a totally different topic. What we're looking at here are examples of gradients. Now, gradient is a pretty general word referring to a difference in some variable from one place to another. For instance, the top example is an example. There's all kinds of gradients. The top one is an example of a gravitational gradient, which you have whenever there is a difference in elevation between two locations. One of them is farther from the center of the Earth than the other one. You have a gravitational gradient, in other words, a hill. And that means if something happens to be placed at the higher elevation, there is a tendency for it to fall naturally to the lower elevation, right? Things fall downhill. They never fall uphill. Well, that's just one example of a gradient. You can have all kinds of gradients, like concentration gradients, differences in the concentration of some particle at one place versus another. Those are really important in cell biology. You can have an electrical gradient, which is exactly what we call a voltage. You know, there's an electrical gradient between one electrode and the other in the receptacle that you put an AC plug into. That's the reason it gives you energy to work. And that's an important point, by the way. Gradients are forms of potential energy. And as such, they're able to do some work for you if things are set up properly. For instance, the work of moving the wagon. That's only going to happen if you start uphill, not downhill, right? It's the gradient that's actually providing that potential energy that will allow that wagon to move. To move that wagon uphill, that's never going to happen on its own. It's going to require some input of energy, right? Similarly for any other gradient. So a pressure gradient is shown as a second example. This is exactly the kind of gradient you have with a garden hose. Right, when you turn on the spigot, if the nozzle is still closed, you build up pressure in the hose itself as it swells, right? You open the nozzle, and now you have a pretty steep pressure gradient from inside the hose to outside the hose. Well, the water is going to flow down its pressure gradient. That's why water always comes out. It doesn't get sucked in when you open up the nozzle. This is how your circulation works, right? The heart is just a pump that produces high pressure where the heart is compared to lower pressure elsewhere, and therefore blood always moves unidirectionally from that higher pressure to the lower pressure. Concentration gradients allow for diffusion to occur. Diffusion is an example of passive transport of particles down their concentration gradient. This is a major way in which certain things get into or out of cells through the plasma membrane that defines every cell. And that's true for molecules and atoms and ions. And there's also a thermal gradient shown here on the bottom. Thermal gradient is a difference in temperature from one place to another. And this is what I was talking about moments ago when I said an overheated body is going to send, it's going to perfuse the skin, going to send blood to the skin in greater quantities. Well, blood, like all materials, is carrying heat. What's the difference between heat and temperature, by the way, real quickly? They're not the same thing. Temperature is a measure of the average speed of the particles of whatever sample you're talking about. So they're all moving at their own speed, but if you were able to get in there and measure each one separately and then divide by the number of particles, that would give you the average speed. Well, that's what the temperature really is. And that is an intensive property, not an extensive property. An intensive property is one that doesn't matter how much stuff you have. For instance, a swimming pool has a certain temperature. If you take 1 milliliter of water out of that swimming pool, at least immediately before you let it sit for a while, it will have the same exact temperature as the pool. It doesn't matter that the pool has a hell of a lot more water in it. But heat is the energy of the movement of particles. And therefore, it's an extensive property. The extent, how much you have, really matters. The pool has a hell of a lot more heat than the milliliter of water that you subsampled from that pool. Okay? But anyway, materials have heat, including blood. Blood is a fluid. Fluid is a liquid or a gas. Anything that flows is a fluid. It's a liquid or a gas. And so when it flows around in the circulation, it moves heat around. If you preferentially perfuse the skin, send that blood to the surface, then what you're doing is putting heat as close as possible to the outside of your body, where if it happens to be an air temperature that's cooler than your body, heat will go out of your body via diffusion of actual heat by conduction. That's separate from sweating, by the way. They both work hand in hand. All right, slide 7, which I think might be the last slide for this first chapter. This is a table I included not only because it's useful in its own right, it's just reminding you or pointing out to you that because so many of the anatomical terms, like biological terms in general, are derived from Latin and Greek, that many of them have non-standard plural endings. It's not simply adding an S. And so that's one point of putting this slide up. For instance, media is a plural, one that I hear misused every day when I look at the news. People are always saying, the media is. That's wrong. It should be the media are. If you're talking about one specific medium, use the word medium. If you're talking about newspapers, for instance, that's one medium of many media. Anyway, it's that's one point of this thing. But the other point is that something I already told you. Pay attention to language, and this course, I think, will be a lot easier. All righty? Let's go to the next chapter.